The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
All right, well, thanks for coming on. Thanks for getting up early and coming to see this. So, I hope this is interesting. So, I work at the Sydney Institute for Astronomy. I'm an astronomer and an astrophysicist. One of the reasons why people do astronomy and astrophysics is because the universe looks like that. Right? This is not anything you need a massive telescope to get. All you need is a slightly dark site and a decent camera and some patience and some warm clothes. And you can take that kind of photo of the Milky Way. One of the great things about the universe is that the harder you look at it, the more beautiful it gets. So the night sky on a dark night is just phenomenally beautiful, but the bigger the telescope you build, the more beauty you see there. And if you are like me and a maths nerd as well, then there's an extra level of beauty behind the whole thing, which is the laws of physics that describe the whole lot. So I want to look at those laws, and in particular to present a puzzle, not a sort of, you know, easy, just present to the public kind of puzzle, but a puzzle that's right at the forefront of an awful lot of research today. But to get there, I just need to give you a quick background on all of physics. So hopefully that's not too much too early in the morning. Here we go. Yeah, we've got this. Good. All right. So let me start from the start, or from the bottom, really. So, if you think of the universe as a Lego set, which is doing some extraordinary things, if we get all, you know, pieces of that Lego set and smash them together until the smallest bits come out, the smallest bit we've seen so far is called a quark. Right? Quarks and electrons. So far as we know, they are the smallest stuff. I'll try to explain the stuff that's on the board, on the thing, if you can't see it. So, out of quarks, so we can then build stuff up. So the all the stuff you see around us, all of this is made out of three basic pieces called the up quark, the down quark, and the electron. All right, put those away for a trivia quiz at some point in the future. That might win you something. Okay, so we start building stuff up, right? What can you make out of the Lego set? Right, put an up quark and down quarks together, you can make protons and neutrons. So if you're playing along at home, two ups and a down makes a proton, and the other way around makes a neutron. So out of protons and neutrons, we can make the nuclei of atoms, right? Protons and neutrons stick together in various combinations, and if you put those in the middle, you get there, you know, six of each makes a carbon atom, carbon-12, and then the electrons can go around the outside. And all the different ways you can do that, in particular the number of protons you put in the middle, determines what kind of element it is, so that gives you the whole periodic table, right? If that's too small to read, then that's good. I'm probably not giving you flashbacks of chemistry here. That's all fine. So the order there of the elements, hydrogen, helium, ... is just how many protons they have in their nucleus. So all the different ways you can put those combinations together makes the periodic table. There's also the electrons that go around the outside. And so if you put nuclei close to each other, the electrons, instead of just going around one nucleus, right, take a complicated route around the whole thing, right, around the sort of Mickey Mouse shape of the water atom. Can I stand back? Can people over there see? Yeah. All right. By doing that, they bind the whole thing together, and hey presto, that is a two-sentence summary of chemistry. Right? That's all there is. For a physicist, that's all there is to it. There's electrons that go around in complicated orbits. Voila, chemistry. Right? So that's how you make molecules, and our universe is exceptionally good at this. Okay. So that, if you put that sequence of nuclei in that particular arrangement, the electrons will take a complicated orbits around the whole thing, bind it all together, and that's DNA. So you can literally write the instructions for a person out of those pieces. Okay? DNA codes for the structure of certain proteins, so you put that in the right cellular factory and you make all the proteins that make cells. So there's a cell with all its marvellous bits. For example, every cell in your body, every cell, not just the body as a whole, but each cell has its own postal system. If it wants to get one molecule from one side to another, it literally puts a little stamp on it with an address, loads it into a little truck, sends it down a highway, where it gets checked by another molecule, and if it's at the right location, it gets unloaded and put to work where it needs to be put to work, right? Molecules do all of that. You've just given it a whole heap of other molecules to work with. That's all happening in your cells as we speak. And finally, if you put enough cells together, you can make some munchkins who eat ice cream. And that's a basic summary of how you get from the basic pieces of our universe up to small children. Right? With enough ice cream, they become larger children. Now, some assembly is required here, of course. As I note, it's not quite as simple as that to make, you know, better methods are available. But that's the basic story of how you build complex structure out of the smallest bits of our universe. Okay? So if that was all too much science too early in the morning for you, let me summarise. Thus far, you're made out of stuff. We're all okay, we're all on board with that so far. Good. If you're a physicist, then you know the equations that describe this stuff. And in particular, there's some properties of the stuff that you need to know in order to describe how it works, how all these bits interact with each other. For example, how heavy is an electron? That's a basic number of our universe that describes the stuff we're made out of, but it's not something we can actually predict. It doesn't come out of the equations. We have to put it into the equations. Right? There are a set of all these numbers. How strong are the forces that bind the stuff of the universe together? How heavy are the basic pieces? Cosmic numbers, like how fast is the universe expanding? There are these basic numbers that we need to explain our universe, but that we don't know how to predict. And so what we can do with the equations is play what you might think of as what-if games. Right? We want to know why these numbers are what they are, and so a question we can ask is, what if they were different? What if gravity was stronger, for example?
Is that cut off?
Okay. It's slightly cut, never mind. What if the electron were more massive or less massive, just make it a bit heavier, what happens in the universe? What if atoms were more stable or less stable? What if there were different numbers of dimensions of space and time? That sounds like science fiction, but if you have the equations that describe a certain thing in the universe, you can just add an extra dimension of space or time and see what happens. We can all do all of this on paper, of course. So what kind of universe could there have been? So one of the interesting things that we've been discovering, not to give away the ending, but as I'll discuss in detail, is it's remarkably easy to totally ruin the universe. All that complexity, it's very easy to sort of cut that story off way too early. So let's take an example. Here is our sort of picture, a rather too classical picture, unfortunately, of an atom, a simple atom. In this case, proton binds to neutron, electron goes around the outside, right? It's a deuterium atom, for those playing along. What happens if we change the masses of those fundamental pieces, just make them heavier or lighter? Now, you might think all that's going to do is make this whole thing heavier or lighter, but that's not quite the case, because there's one equation in this talk, E equals MC squared, hopefully you've heard that one before, right? And mass is a form of energy, and energy is kind of the currency of the universe. If you want something to happen, you have to have the energy to pay for it, otherwise it's not going to happen. Energy conservation. So, if you change the masses, you change now the sort of the currency of the universe. There are processes that couldn't happen before because the universe couldn't afford it, which now become possible, all the other way around. There are processes that could happen before but now can't because they can't afford it. So what happens? It's actually remarkably easy changing the fundamental masses to have it so that instead of those protons and neutrons wanting to stick to each other, what they would rather be on their own, so to speak. So that the process which rips the two apart is now the one that the universe can afford, rather than the one that sticks them together. And actually, it's remarkably easy to do even worse than that. You can make it so the electron doesn't go around. It actually spirals into the nucleus, turning protons into neutrons. And so, here's what that does. Here's the periodic table again. And just for fun, this is the astronomer's periodic table. It's coloured according to where the universe makes that particular element. Okay, so hydrogen and helium in purple are made in the Big Bang up the top. The yellow ones, this cluster over on your right, carbon, oxygen. Those ones are made in small stars. The green ones are made in larger stars. And even large stars can't make the biggest atoms. You need to blow up your star in a supernova to make the biggest things, including AU there is gold. So all the gold you might have on your person was made in supernovae. And there are some that had to be made in a laboratory because even the universe can't manage to make these ones. They don't last long enough. Okay. We've changed a couple of these numbers by a seemingly small amount. And what happens to the periodic table? Well, if protons and neutrons don't want to stick to each other, the periodic table looks like this. So one of the great things about this is the chemistry exam in this universe goes as follows. Question one, what is the element? Hydrogen, right? It makes for really cheap periodic tables. You can print that out really easy, stick it on the wall. Question two, what is the chemical reaction? Because there's only one. You can put hydrogen and hydrogen together to make the hydrogen molecule. End of exam, right? That's all the questions you can ask. That's it. There's no other reactions. There's no other elements. That's your chemistry exam. It's a huge shame that there would be no one around in that universe to take that really easy exam. You can actually make it worse. You can make universes where the only stable element has the chemistry of helium. And in that case, the chemistry exam is even easier. What is the element? Helium. End of exam. There are no chemical reaction, right? One question. So, obviously, in that kind of universe, that story I could tell at the start of the complexity in our universe, right? Quarks, nuclei, atoms, molecules, DNA, cells, small children with ice creams, right? That story gets cut off very early, right? Quarks, protons and neutrons, end of story, right? That's all you can make. So all the rest of that complexity goes away, and you kind of ruin the universe for anything interesting, including for any conceivable form of life. So this phenomenon is called the fine-tuning of the universe for life. That if we think of these numbers as kind of a free dial on the universe, if you want to do something interesting in your universe, like life or any sort of complexity, you need to dial it into the right thing. Right? I've learned when I give this talk to high schoolers, they don't know what that is. Okay, so it's great to be talking to a group like this. There are other entertaining ways to ruin the universe. Let me just quickly run through a couple. Here's one of the things I do for a living, which is absolutely marvellous. You put a simulation of a universe in a computer. You have particles that represent a certain amount of stuff in the universe, and you have a whole heap of them. And then you let it expand and interact with each other via gravity and pressure forces, and they make stars, and the stars blow up, and you let all of that happen, and hopefully what turns up at the end of the day is something that looks like galaxies, and then you hope that you've understood something about how galaxies form. So here's an example from the Eagle simulation group. The universe takes on, thanks to gravity, this sort of web-like structure. It's what's called the cosmic web. We can ruin this story as well. If we make gravity too weak, then that process by which anything in the universe which has a lot of mass, any lump of matter, gathers in more stuff and so makes an even bigger thing and on its way builds up and makes a galaxy at the end of the day. If you make gravity too weak, that won't happen. Right? You just end up with a universe with isolated stuff. There are just sort of lonely protons that sit alone in empty space. The most that happens in the history of the universe is another proton comes along, bounces off that proton, and that's the whole story of the history of the universe, right? You could write an extraordinarily boring children's story called The Lonely Proton, right? But not much would happen. We can ruin stars. If you make gravity too strong, then you create problems. In stars in our universe, there's a balance between gravity pushing in and pressure forces pushing out. That's what's holding the sun up. If you make gravity too strong, where am I? Yep. Instead of the star forming a stable thing, it kind of overreacts. Anytime there's a overcompression, and it just blows itself up. You can make stars where anything big enough to burn, to ignite nuclear reactions, blows itself to smithereens. Those are entertaining universes, if you're an astrophysicist. So, if you've got any sort of aspirations of becoming at any point in your life a supervillain, right, then there's some really great ideas here for how to totally ruin the universe, right? These are some phenomenal threats you can make against humanity, right? I'll blow up all your stars. And if you want some more ideas on that, the book we wrote has about 6 chapters of all these entertaining ways in which you can, in which life could have turned out, a universe could have turned out to be totally impossible for any conceivable form of life. So it was written with my, well, current boss, Geraint Lewis, who's at the University of Sydney, and Geraint is an atheist, so the first 7 chapters of the book we wrote together, and that's all about the science, and apart from one footnote, which you can go and find, we agreed on everything. There's a footnote that starts with, at this point our heroic authors disagreed about dot dot dot. But other than that, the science is all pretty much pinned down. So the question then comes in chapter 8, which is in the form of a conversation, what does any of this mean? What do we do with this fact, right? It's a fairly straightforward thing to do in theoretical physics. Let's change this number. What would happen? That's a standard thing theoretical physicists do. What could happen? So here's Geraint's preferred proposal. Something called the multiverse, which has turned up for some reason in comic books. So there's Batman. This is called Infinite Crisis Fight for the Multiverse. There's Batman about to punch someone. Apparently that will help the multiverse in some way or another. There's Superman about to punch someone, which will help the multiverse. Because the idea, how do we explain something unlikely? Well, maybe there were lots of different attempts, lots of different goes at it. Why does anyone win the lottery? Well, because lots of people buy different tickets. How did our universe end up with just the right set of properties for life? Well, maybe there's lots of other universes out there in a multiverse, each with different properties. And if you look hard enough, then you'll find one that supports life. And of course, anyone in that universe will be in a part of the universe that supports life. You have to sort of, you can't look around you and go, hey, this universe is completely impossible for life, because there's no one there to make that observation. So the overall picture you would get of the universe as a whole, if you could sort of massively zoom out on things, would be that here's our universe, which does all these wonderful, interesting things. The whole story from quarks to munchkins, and from the top down, from matter to galaxies and stars, and all meeting beautifully in the middle at planets with life on them. If we could zoom out, we'd see all the other universes, all the failed lottery tickets, where the electron wasn't quite right, the start of the universe wasn't quite right, and they're all dead. Right? If fine-tuning is right, there's an awful lot of dead universes out there for everyone that has life in it. Okay? Geraint's preferred option. It's an option. It's a way the universe could be. The other way it could turn out is there could be a fine-tuner. Now, fine-tuning doesn't mean fine-tuned by a person. That's not what the term means, but it might imply that. So the way I like to think of this is, imagine there's some pieces on a chessboard trying to work out what the rules of chess are. Okay? So they're doing science, right? They watch the other pieces move around and start putting together how their universe works, right? At some point, some entertaining chess piece might actually write down the rules of chess, have totally solved their universe. There's a comedian who's joked that if that ever happened in our universe, what he wants to happen is all our reality dissolves and a sign comes up that says level 2, right? So what fine-tuning suggests is, like, let's take the best laws we have and see what they would look like if they were the ultimate laws. And what it suggests is, even if these totally explain everything, there's still a huge question here about why our universe is the way it is rather than some other way. And if you've totally nailed the laws of nature, then you have to look somewhere else if you want an answer to that question. Just as the chess pieces, if they wonder, you know, why do these laws allow for interesting games of chess, have to look beyond the rules of chess. Right? The reason why chess exists is not there in the rules. It's not because bishops move diagonally. You need a higher level of explanation. So that's the idea here. If you see that it's a meaningful idea that there is a creator of the universe, then fine-tuning makes a lot of sense. Why, amongst all the possibilities, do we see one in which there could be beings who can, you know, who have morally meaningful lives? Well, if there's a creator who set the thing up, then that's something that you can understand rather than trying to explain it purely via chance. So, on that note, I'll leave it there. That's the chapter 8 in our book. Apparently there's copies in Dimmick somewhere, so it'd be great if they sold out at some point. If you could very loudly take it up to the counter, that would be fantastic. But I'll leave it there and take questions. Thank you very much. All right. Should I just... Yeah, let's just go at random. Which areas of science have the most Christians involved from your experience? From my experience, I'm not sure, but I think in just from surveys, it's the physical sciences more than any of the other sciences for some reason. It's physics and astronomy and those sciences which actually have more theists involved in it than, say, especially like the social sciences and moving off that end into the arts faculty. So I've heard from surveys. So what that means, I'm not entirely sure, but that's an interesting little fact. Do we know whether there is life elsewhere in our universe? Right. Experience tells me that no matter what I talk about, I get that question. It doesn't matter what I've... Right. Yeah, I could do... Yeah, anyway, okay. It is actually relevant to this talk. The short answer is we don't know because the biologists are letting the team down. Okay, so if you wanted to know scientifically whether there was life in the rest of it, happy to blame biologists, in the rest of the universe, what you want to know is how many suitable places are there for life to form, and then what's the probability that life would form given a suitable place. So the first part of that question is, how many planets are out there that would have sort of liquid water on their surface, be the right distance from their sun, all those sorts of things? That's the astronomy side of things. And so we've had searches for planets. It seems there's roughly at least sort of a planet per star in the universe, and some fraction of those, which isn't going to be completely negligible, will have sort of roughly the right conditions for life. It'll have liquid water on its surface, for example. So... That side of the equation we kind of know. The other side is, if you have a planet like that with all the right stuff on the surface and you bake it for a billion years, will it make life? And we don't know. Right. I mean, if our universe could be... Earth could be a complete freak, right, in the universe for that, and we'd never know, just because the only place where anyone is asking these questions are where life formed. So, do we know whether there is life in our universe? No, we don't. Sorry. We'd all love to know. Do we really know where the elements were made, e.g. gold and supernova, hydrogen only in the Big Bang, or is this our best theory at the moment? So we know the rough fractions of stuff in the universe, what fraction of the universe is helium and hydrogen and all those sorts of things. We know that because there's very bright things in the universe called quasars. As they come across the universe, their light comes through the universe, it picks up in silhouette the trace of anything that's on along the way, and so in this way you can sort of take a survey of all the stuff that's in the universe. So we know that the vast majority of the universe is hydrogen and helium, and when we calculate how much helium would we expect if the Big Bang happened, we would get that number just about right, and the amount of deuterium, which is wonderful. Yes, it is a theory. Of course it's a theory, because we haven't watched the whole history of the universe, but it is a theory that's backed up by observations, which accounts for the data better than other theories. Victor Stenger claims that fine-tuned parameters are linked, so fine-tuning is only apparent. My first foray into publishing in this area was a very long review article which responded to Victor Stenger's book on this. I think he is totally wrong and completely ruins all the physics, so I have explained that in far too much length in an article called The Fine-Tuning of the Universe for Life. It's in the publications of the Astronomical Society of Australia if you want to see it. Victor, we had a bit of a back and forth, and Victor unfortunately passed away I think a year or two ago. There is no evidence that these parameters are linked. They are not linked in the best theories that we have. And if there was a link, it would not be any kind of necessary link. It would be another contingent link dependent on other things. And so we would just look at a deeper level to see whether there was fine-tuning there. So he gets far too much of the physics wrong to make that sort of claim. Is a multiverse incompatible with God? No, I don't think it is. In particular, the simplest way... Oh, sorry, just keep an eye on the time. The simplest way to make the life-permitting universe might be just to have a simple mechanism that keeps churning out universes and just wait for the right combination to turn up somewhere. That might be a very simple method of creation, if you like. So they're compatible. I think there are other independent problems with the multiverse, but I don't think the two are mutually exclusive. Depends on what sort of picture you have of God, I suppose. How many dead universes do we expect in a multiverse, or to support a multiverse? In a multiverse, what fraction of the universes do we think would actually have life? That's hard to put a number on because it depends on how you're cranking out these extra universes, right? What's the mechanism that's producing all these other tickets? But the sort of order of magnitude things that come out of these kind of considerations is if you look at the total range of masses that quarks could have and electrons and those sorts of things, the fraction that would actually allow for life, you're looking at sort of one part in a number with about 30 digits in it. And there are other numbers where that, you know, has about 50 digits in it. We're looking at extraordinarily small probabilities. So if you want, you would need an awful lot of tickets in the lottery to get a winning one somewhere. So it seems like we would need an awful lot of universes in the multiverse to actually explain fine-tuning. But if you've got a universe generator and it, you know, it keeps pumping them out, then that's a possibility. How do astrophysicists deal with other moral issues of why we are here or day-to-day issues? One of the great things about being an astrophysicist is there's that section in any research proposal form which says, are there any moral issues related to your research? And you get to tick no, which is wonderful. Like all the biophysicists, you know, biochemists and all that sort of thing. How many rats are you going to kill in the making of your experiments? We don't have any of those sorts of problems, which is really great, right? There's a great big telescope. We're going to look through it. More generally, there is, you know, life outside of the telescope, if you want to say it that way. I think astrophysicists in that case are sort of like anyone else. There are moral principles you need to guide your life, and you won't see those looking through a telescope, and they won't come out of your equations at any point. You do need some sort of principles. So, as a community, I actually find leaning an awfully long way to the left might not surprise any of you to the point of falling over. There are these broader issues. There's a small subset of scientists who are trying to make the case that actually we can get all of our morals from science, right? We do science and we make... you mumble something about human flourishing and then you cite a whole heap of research about what promotes human flourishing and you say that science has solved it. I don't find that to be a very common kind of view, certainly not in principle. There are all sorts of moral positions that scientists have but they don't even pretend have come out of their science. They're just the way they live their lives. So, in terms of the bigger issues about why are we here, a lot of scientists are naturalists, so that question simply doesn't have an answer. There are no answers to the big why questions. The universe just is, and that's all there is to it. So you end up asserting that the universe exists and has these laws as a brute fact, and then you try to explain everything else from there up. But by definition, it's not just those questions don't have answers yet. They are literally unanswerable. There is no fact about reality which would answer those questions. That is naturalism, right? I think a lot of physicists would do that because that seems like the simplest thing. You just go, you know, whatever down there, and then let's do science, hooray. So in those sorts of things, I am not of that view, but that, I think, is the predominant view. Any other questions? Happy to... Oh yeah, it is completely impractical. So one of the things you can calculate from physics as we know it is what's the energy scale of a chemical reaction and the energy scale of a nuclear reaction, right? If you want to turn lead into gold, right, alchemy, you need to mess around with the nucleus, right? You need to take lead pull some neutrons and protons out, and then hey presto, you've got gold. The energy scale difference is about one part is about a factor of 100,000, right? Which tells you why alchemy doesn't work, right? Light all the fires you like, That's a chemical reaction, right? You just make the electrons buzz around a bit. At no point do you make anything with enough energy to mess with the nucleus of anything, right? Which is great, because if you leave a cake in the oven for too long, it doesn't turn into a lump of lead, right? You will ignite chemical reactions, but not nuclear reactions. So if you want to make gold, then you'd need some very extreme conditions, and even the centers of very hot stars aren't enough. The reason for that is... before you get to gold, so basically the story of stars is you take smaller atoms, you smash them together, you make bigger, sorry, smaller nuclei, you smash them together, make bigger nuclei, and you get energy out, and that runs the star. There is stellar astrophysics for you. That works up until iron. And the problem with iron is you smash two iron nuclei together to make something, it eats energy rather than gives out energy. And so the process which was stabilizing the star is now totally undermining the star, and the whole thing collapses and you get a supernova. Out of that comes gold. So, yeah, if you want to make gold, all you have to do is blow up a star. What is life? Great question. To which there are 1,000 different answers. We're physicists, right? So, I mean, the short story is we don't know. What we can isolate is, I think, some of the necessary conditions, or at least on a case-by-case basis, look at a universe and say, this doesn't have any of the complexity we would need for anything that could be called life. So a universe where the only thing that happens is two protons bounce off each other and then leave, is not one that has the kind of complexity you need for anything that we call life. There's no way it could, by any definition, there's nothing in that you could call metabolism, nothing you could call reproduction, there's nothing you could call isolating its internal state from its environment, there's no way you're doing Darwinian evolution in that universe. None of that happens. And so it's not that we know exactly how life forms, it's that we can identify cases in which nothing like life could possibly happen. But the broader question of where you draw the line between, like, is a virus alive? It can't reproduce on its own, it needs a host. Or is it, you know, is a computer alive? These sorts of questions we don't sort of need to touch. We're interested in the necessary preconditions for life rather than an exact definition of what it is and what it isn't. Does that answer your question? Why is the universe so information rich? It's kind of a similar question. If you ask that question, you would get the fine-tuning of the universe for information. So our universe starts off in a very simple state. So if you the earliest stages of the universe, you can write down a pretty complete description of what's going on a single piece of paper. Right? If we fast forward way off into the future, it'll end up in a very simple state as well, right? Probably isolated protons surrounded by empty space. Again, one sheet of paper will do it. All the interesting stuff happens in the middle because of fine-tuning, right? All that structure of galaxies I showed, all the interesting chemical reactions, all that stuff happens in the middle because of fine-tuning and because as I'll talk about next week, the start is an orderly start. Right? The universe starts out in an orderly state. So in that sense, it's sort of, you know, ready to go to do interesting stuff. But there's an awful lot of other universes out there which wouldn't do any of that stuff. It would go from a simple start to a simple end without doing anything interesting in the middle. How did I get into astrophysics? Basically via this, there's a couple of ways that astronomers get into it. I got via being a maths nerd and then discovering that physics is kind of amazing because all this stuff applies to the universe, and then if you can do physics, then astrophysics is a particularly interesting brand of it, particularly cosmology, the science of the universe as a whole. So that's how I got in. There are other people who, you know, I had a telescope when I was 6 months old, and I memorized all the stars when I was 5, and all that sort of stuff. That's not, I can identify about 3 constellations. And to be honest, I can't think of what the third one is. So, like Southern Cross, maybe. Anyway, So I'm a theorist. So astronomy divides basically into the theorists who do the maths and the equations, all that sort of stuff. There's the observers who go to the telescope, take the data, analyze the data, and then there's the instrumentalists who make the instruments that take the data. So all three need to be moving together. The head of the department, when I started my PhD, described that setup as the defenders, the midfielders, and the strikers, right? All the observers came back to him. Hang on, why do the theorists get to be the strikers? We're the strikers. So I'm a striker. I'm one of the theorists. I'm at that end of things. So maths and all that sort of stuff.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.